Today in Studio 360, the singer-songwriter Shilpa Ray is the only punk harmonium player I've ever heard, but it was not her first choice of instrument.
I hated it. I couldn't stand playing. I want to play harmonium.
I'll talk with Shilpa Ray about how those Indian classical lessons paid off. I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. But to start the show, if you've seen any of his movies, and I'm sure you have, you know that Jeff Daniels is great at playing jerks. Not totally loathsome jerks. From Terms of Endearment to The Squid and the Whale, he's had a special knack for those deeply flawed guys who make mistakes and somehow convince you that deep down they're just wounded. The same is true, and then some by a couple of orders of magnitude, of his role in the current Broadway play Blackbird. He plays a man who at age 40 had sex with his neighbor, who was 12 years old. 15 years later, after Daniel's character has served time in prison and started over with a new name, the girl, now a woman, played by Michelle Williams, tracks him down at his office. The play is what happens over the next couple of hours.
You were on my mind all the time. I left work early. I work on my car on the street. Didn't need work. Took things apart, put them back together. The engine was perfect, but I had to, because you'd be there and we could talk. It was fine. It was in the open. No one thought anything. Your parents, the kids that played there. But it wasn't enough. I had to be alone with you.
Jeff Daniels, it is great to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here.
So this play, Blackbird, you did it almost a decade ago off-Broadway. I can't imagine wanting to play a pedophile once. Here you are doing the role again, because how come?
No, it ain't a Disney movie. I know that. They're hard. Some roles are real hard to play. They're complex. And I had thrown what I thought was everything I had at it before. And I remember Dustin Hoffman came to see it, and he came backstage, and he was very complimentary, but he kind of looked at me and said, you know, you underplayed it, didn't you? And, you know, from someone of his stature, going, that's his way of saying there's more there. And, you know, I walked away from it, and I'd done what I thought was my best regardless, And then Scott Rudin called 9 years later and said,
the producer.
Yeah, Scott Rudin said, let's take it to Broadway. And that was kind of my first thought is, you know, as despicable as this play and what this character has done and what you have to go through to get there to become him, I hadn't gone all the way.
Really?
And I wanted to, and especially, God, I've been at this almost 40 years, to maybe learn something new, to maybe fail, to risk failure by going further is the reason why you keep going. So
same director, but different co-star.
Alison Pill had done it before. She's living and working happily ever after on the West Coast. So she,
who was one of your co-stars in Newsroom,
and said good luck, and I'll come and see you and laugh at you and all the pain you're going through. And then we landed on Michelle Williams, which is
a good place to land.
She's a joy. She really is.
She's amazing, as are you in this play.
She's just fearless. She just is a walking, talking nerve ending. And you can feel her feel it. And
yeah.
It's thrilling to play off of someone who can do that.
One of the crucial things to this play, it seems to me, is that the sense of grays it maintains about this subject that seems very black and white. So as you're playing this guy 8 nights a week for, you know, an hour and a half a night, do you have a sense going in, okay, this is how I feel about how much moral guilt he/I should feel I mean, do you have the whole sense of what's in his head that we don't see and you don't say?
I think there's a spinning that's happening this time, that's happening this time that didn't happen before. And it has to do with her. It has to do with he was 40 and she was 12. And as wrong as it was, can the love of your life now at 27 years old be standing there right in front of you? Your life has been nothing since. It's nothing now. And yet here was, wrong as it was, the best thing that ever happened to you. How do you justify that? How do you come to grips with that? How do you accept that? And you don't, and he doesn't. And that's what's kind of thrilling about what David Harrower did with the script, is that you watch these two people work it out.
On the page, which I haven't read the play, on the page is your character, Ray, or whatever he's called now, supposed to be likable, earnest, as well as having done this inexcusable crime?
I don't think about that. I don't care. It's the only way to only way to go at it.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, move to Hollywood, brand yourself, get an image.
And play the same thing over and over.
And be that guy who goes, really wonderful play. I think it's terrific. Going to need a speech on about page 70 where I redeem myself and they feel good about it. So why don't you do the rewrite on that? I've got a brand. I mean, I've got a brand. So Circle Rep didn't bring me up that way. Right. That isn't how we think here. So so I throw it at, and if Joe wants more of that, he'll put more of it in.
Yeah. And Circle Rep being a theater that, especially in the 70s and 80s when you were new to New York, was the off-Broadway epicenter.
It really was a home for the new American play. That's where I trained. That's where I learned. And that's the playbook I use today.
So thinking about some of your finest performances, like in Terms of Endearment.
I'm not doing anything.
Oh, no. Yes, you
please.
Are.
I hate it when you get this unhappy, okay? We go through this stage every time.
No, don't change the subject.
And in The Squid and the Whale.
Ivan is fine, but he's not a serious guy. He's a Philistine.
What's a Philistine?
It's a guy who doesn't care about books or interesting films and things. Your mother's brother, Ned, is also a Philistine.
And now, certainly in this, a lot of these great characters you've done are some version of a jerk. Not necessarily villains, but they are definitely non-heroic.
They're characters with flaws, kind of like us, you know?
Yeah, but maybe more flaws than we have.
Oh, maybe. But certainly in comparison to some of the squeaky clean heroes that you might see in a lot of movies, as soon as they have a flaw, they, redeem themselves.
Yeah.
And these guys don't. They kind of live with them.
Yeah.
And I just find that interesting. And whether they're – I'm certainly way back when, getting out of the gate with Terms of Endearment as a guy who can – make unlikable at least interesting to watch for the length of the movie. If that's how you get out of the gate, as I did in 83, that's what you get thrown at you.
Right.
Repeat that. Do that again. Do that again.
So that was a good thing. Did it feel like, whoa, I have won the lottery. This is amazing?
No. Because I had a lot to learn. You get on a set with Jack, Shirley, and Deborah. And you realize how little you know about film acting. So I shut up and listened and learned a lot. I was thrown around really, really great people. Meryl was there in Heartburn.
I guess that's Meryl Streep.
Later on in The Hours. And when you get around people that have been doing it longer than you have, you might want to learn.
Sure.
And so that was my approach. It was never, I'm equal, I'm with them, look how good I am. It was never that.
I understand. Okay, so we're talking about craft. What kinds of things did you learn early on from those folks?
How to be on camera, how to repeat it, how to make it alive. You could look at Meryl would look at you in the middle of a two-shot, and it would just freeze you.
A two-shot meaning you're both in the frame.
A two-shot meaning the both of us are in the frame. And then you got it. So things like that, how to be off camera, how do you get ready? You can't just put down a sandwich and walk in front of the camera. You got to pick up something from where how do you sustain that? Things like the mechanics of film acting. I just went to, it was a masterclass.
But beyond what you learned as an actor, as a craft, what about, wow, what about in a career? Oh, now I can do whatever I want. I'm famous. I can go anywhere, do anything. Was that a sensation?
No, because that's what you learn in star school.
What, you dropped out of star school?
Never made it. I applied. No, that's I'm famous, so that answers everything. No, look at all that. No, it is fleeting. It doesn't last long. You're only as good as your next performance. That's why I came back to Blackbird. You know, you got to keep challenging yourself, because especially now.
Right.
Everybody, you're famous for, forget 15 minutes, 15 seconds.
Yeah.
And if you aren't doing something to sustain it.
Right.
So that you can continue working. You're going to look up 10 years ago. It was the last good thing you did.
Right.
And if you don't.
You're going to be in Sunset Boulevard.
If you don't get plastic surgery, you're done.
Yeah. So speaking of not going to star school, you and your wife, whom you married out of high school, I mean, you were boyfriend, girlfriend, marrier when you were young. Then you moved back to your hometown.
Mm-hmm.
Was that because, that's just a better way to live and I don't want to live in Los Angeles or New York?
Oh, there was always a fatalistic view of this career. I didn't believe it would last. They usually don't. And I didn't know how to live in Hollywood. I knew how to live in New York, but it was fast becoming too expensive, even a one bedroom in the early 80s. We had a 2-year-old. We were going to have more. And I had gone back for summers to Michigan, where we had a cottage on a lake. And we had been there from June to August. And the next summer, it was May to September. And the next one was April to October. I'm going, we can operate out of here. Let's try. And so I did. I used the Detroit airport and dropped back and did supporting roles and lived in a place where we knew how to raise our kids.
Right.
She's from there. I'm from there. It just was easier. And then when the career is over, when you get that call on Tuesday,
it's not a big drop.
You're already there. You're already home. You don't have to move. It literally was that kind of, this is just, I mean, it's been great. I've done 5 movies.
It's so Midwestern. I'm from Nebraska, so I know what I'm talking about.
You're expecting it. You're expecting the worst.
Yeah. So you make this choice, really or self-deprecatingly, because you thought you would fail. You move back to your hometown.
Survivalist. Yeah.
You move back to your hometown. You stay married to this same person for 37
The same person.
37
I'll
years.
Tell her you said so.
The same beautiful woman that you
Hello,
fell in love with.
You same person you.
I'm saying it a good thing. You're married to one person for 37 years.
Yeah.
You live in this small town in flyover country. You drive your own RV to Los Angeles when you're doing Newsroom and live in it. In addition to seeming like a normal American guy who has good values and keeps his feet on the ground, you like, and then some. I mean, it's kind of wonderfully extreme, it seems to me.
Is it eccentric?
Kinda, given who you are and what you do, kinda, yeah.
Yeah. Look, it all goes back to Circle Red. You're not a star, you're an actor. We're going to teach you how to be an actor. We don't know how to teach you to be a star. We can do that, and you can get better at being an actor your entire life. Why don't you focus on that? And I just stuck to it. And God, when you move to Michigan, the first thing you find, there are peaks and valleys in every career, especially when you operate out of the Midwest. To last 40 years, to have longevity means the only thing you can control is if you're getting better as an actor, you're not dropping, you're not settling. That's the only thing you can control in this out of control, who's hot, youth-oriented business.
Right. What roles happen to be available.
That's what I've done.
Right.
And the fact that I'm still around and that Aaron Sorkin calls at a time when the career is going down.
Is that right?
Yeah. Here's Aaron Sorkin going, we want you to do Newsroom. That doesn't happen to people in their late 50s. That doesn't happen. I got friends of mine that in the 70s and 80s were off-Broadway. I mean, they're screaming for work. So I'm appreciative, and all I have to do is the best that I can do with this role. Everything else I could care less about.
So Aaron Sorkin calls you, you get this part, HBO picks up the show. There were a lot of people who really didn't like Newsroom and made a hobby of hating it.
Yeah.
Was that weird and difficult season after season for you?
Less so for me than it was for Aaron. They really attacked him.
Yes.
we worked real hard on that show, and then to see this kind of overreaction towards him and towards his writing ticked me off, that's for sure. He was my creative brother, still is. You know, you want to step up for him. I thought, and they'll all run off and write their little blogs about how this isn't true, but I remember you look up Paddy Chayefsky in Network, and he got the crap beat out of him just like Aaron did. And maybe there's something with, not entirely, so, you know, calm down, but maybe there's something with, it's okay to point the camera and point your story at this and that, but don't point it at us, the media. Don't tell us what we're doing wrong. There were some TV people that were just, you know, one guy said at the premiere, he goes, we're told to lay off you because they think you're coming after us. And this is one of the leading news cable people.
Don't go all conspiracist on me. I don't think that was the source, but maybe.
Well, then calm the hell down because it's just a television show.
But that's what's interesting, you know, is it's a television series. I mean, a network can come on. Okay, people can hate it. And then it's gone. This, the fact that it lasted for a few years, it would have been, if I were Aaron Sorkin, and maybe not you, it would have been tough, really tough.
I think it lasted 3 years. I think if they had loved it, perhaps we'd still be going.
Yeah.
That certainly factored in. He also wrote every word for 3 years. And, you know, he had writers around a table, but it wasn't the standard television series where he passes an episode around and he wrote every word. So that's a lot. Every 2 weeks, you got to drop 80 pages of brilliant.
Right.
And that's hard to do.
Right.
And for anyone.
Right. So for 25 years, it looks like you've run this theater company in Chelsea, Michigan, population 5,000, the Purple Rose Theater Company.
Mm-hmm.
You're 20 minutes from Ann Arbor, so that implies an audience not so far away. But I can't imagine this has been an easy thing to do. And it looks like a completely thriving enterprise.
It's been rewarding and difficult. The difficulty is in raising the money for the arts. The arts supporters are fewer than they are in, say, New York. You're in a place where a lot of people really love to watch American Idol, and you're trying to throw some stuff at them that isn't necessarily always going to have a happy ending. And you're trying to, in a way, not all of them, but teach a majority of your audience how to be theater goers, what theater is, what it can do, what it can be.
Is part of this not like you think you're going to fail, but do you like having a lot of different things going? And you're also a musician. You know, you play the guitar. You go have gigs every, you know, 25 gigs a year. Is this all part of the Midwestern, I just want to have all these things going in case this one becomes untenable? Or is it just...
That's good. Is that a Midwestern thing?
Well, I extrapolate my own feeling to all Midwesterners, so maybe.
Fallback positions?
Exactly. Four legs on the stool.
The music has always been a fallback.
Yeah.
I've played when I first came to New York in 76, and I just fell in love with writing. And I just would do it for myself. And then later, about 30 years later, we needed to raise money at my theater company.
Huh.
And I had been playing just on my back porch, and I would write, and it was just something I was doing for me because we're not going to have me go out. I'm an actor. I'm not going to be William Shatner. There's such a stigma.
Oh, be William Shatner.
But there's such a stigma of actors who now suddenly are rock stars.
Yeah. Lucy and the Sky with Diamonds.
I get it. Yeah. I get it. Yeah. I'm not going to do it. Yeah. This is just for me. I'm getting better at the acoustic guitar. That's enough. That's enough. It's a creative outlet.
But you play a lot in public.
Well, then, 2002 or so, they said, why don't you, we'll put a chair on the stage of the theater and you can go out between Christmas and New Year's, we'll sell 10 shows, hike up the ticket, and we'll raise a ton of money for nothing. I was the chief fundraiser and I'm going, oh boy, okay. Went out there terrified, sweating. I had pit stains down to my belt. My friends of mine were looking going, breathe, just breathe, sitting in the audience. And I, after about three holiday seasons of this show, I figured out it's, you don't have a character. You don't have a filter. You don't have, you know, even like a blackbird, you're using you, but still right. There's this protective filter. So I said, I'm, it's like a talk show. It's like Letterman or Leno or, you know.
Do a version of yourself.
You in a good mood.
Yeah.
It's Jeff in a good mood.
This would be the second verse. Thematically speaking, it's the same as the first. To kill some time, think I'm gonna change the chords. Now I'm right back where I used to be before. I gave it all I had, oh, I tried my best. Oh, come up empty, I swung and missed. So hit a little something, goes something like this. Hit a little something, goes something like this.
Yeah.
So that's the character. Jeff's in a good mood, walk out with a guitar. And then I was good. I didn't sweat at all.
Huh.
So, but that was something that before Newsroom, I was going, okay, you might have had a really good run and you might want to think about doing something else. So I really went and ratcheted up the guitar playing, especially the acoustic guitar, gigging. But I was serious about it, am serious about it. But then Newsroom happened, and now Blackbird's happening, and the movie, the career is not dead yet. So
So the career is getting in the way of your music career.
It's completely gotten in the way.
Huh. You have had, it has. You, these last couple of years, really, has been, you won an Emmy for Newsroom. You've got roles in two Oscar-nominated films. You had The Martian and Steve Jobs. This show, this excellent show on Broadway in which you are excellent. And I read that you have a role in the new movie in the Divergent series, Allegiant. What's going on? Why just you wait long enough and the clock comes around and hits you again?
I don't know.
You're the new Harrison Ford.
Am I?
I think.
Is that a good thing?
I think that's, you know, if that's, as long as you still got the guitar thing happening and the playwriting thing happening, that's a fine thing.
Yeah.
And don't fly helicopters.
Listen,
okay?
I can be Harrison Ford until it doesn't work and then I got to have something to fall back on.
Exactly. Jeff Daniels, thank you very much for putting up with me, and this has been a pleasure.
Thank you, Kurt. Appreciate it.
Blackbird is on Broadway now.
Thanks a lot.
Good. It's fun.
Yeah. Thanks. This week on the Studio 360 podcast, we put out my interview with the director Ridley Scott. He got his big break directing the first Alien movie in 1979, and he's now working on a prequel to Alien. But when we talked, he told me how he almost did not catch that break.
I was the fifth choice. Huh? I was the fifth director chosen. The guy before me was Robert Altman. Who on earth would offer Bob Alien? And Bob would say, what?
I'd never heard that. I kind of want to see that version just to see what it would have been.
Here you go. Are you kidding me?
In an alternate universe, there's a very different version of Alien. In this universe, you can find my conversation with Ridley Scott in your Studio 360 podcast feed on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get podcasts. Coming up, the writer David Foster Wallace is often remembered for this great, odd graduation speech, for some pieces of journalism about cruise ships and state fairs and lobsters. But it's a novel, one novel, that was his greatest achievement.
You know, David's great cause in Infinite Jest, but also afterward, was to write a kind of realistic novel for a world that was no longer real.
It is the 20th anniversary of Infinite Jest, and I'll talk with David Foster Wallace's biographer. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson.
What day is it?
Income tax day.
Income tax day.
Tax day is still more than a month away. Plenty of time. So instead of gathering together all those receipts this weekend, why not enter our new listener challenge? It's called Defile Your Taxes, and I'll let the guest judge explain what it's all about.
Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace. Like you, I enjoy filing taxes about as much as hammering nails into my kneecaps. But here is a fun tax-related thing to do. I want you to print out a 1040 tax form and make something really creative and cool out of it. You could paint or draw on the form. You can make origami out of it, fill it out satirically as, I don't know, Elmer Fudd, maybe? Wascally Wabbits? Anything goes. You have until April the 3rd to enter. I'm judging this creative challenge, and I can't wait to see what you come up with. Find out all the details at studio360.org/defile.
And Kai will be back to announce the winner on
April 15th.
April 15th.
What's so special about April 15th?
I don't know.
Twenty years ago, when I was just about to start my first novel, which I wanted to be big and funny and serious and realistic and say fresh things about modern life, a new novel appeared on my doorstep. A gigantic novel, 1,000 pages in galleys, signed by the author. It was signed David Foster Wallace, and the book was Infinite Jest. I plunged in and realized why so much fuss was being made. It was really a dazzling, infuriating, completely remarkable book about the sadness that Wallace saw at the core of our frenzied American addiction to entertainment and diversion. Just to give you a sense of his writing, here is Wallace himself reading from Infinite Jest about his character Lyle, this freakish guru who lives in the locker room of the Enfield Tennis Academy, where a lot of the novel takes place.
This guru lives off the sweat of others, literally, the fluids and salts and fatty acids. You do like maybe some sets of benches, some leg curls, inclined abs, crunches, work up a good hot shellac of sweat. Then if you let him lick your arms and forehead, he'll pass on to you some little nugget of fitness guru wisdom. His big one for a long time was, quote, "And the Lord said, let not the weight thou would pull to thyself exceed thine own weight." His advice on conditioning and injury prevention tends to be pretty solid, is the consensus. His tongue is little and rough, but feels good, like a kitty's. It isn't like a faggy or sexual thing. Some of the girls let him lick them, too. He's harmless as they come. Some of the newer kids think he's a creep and want him out of there. What kind of guru wears spandex and lives off others' perspiration, they complain. Sometimes the newer kids, who won't even let him near them, come in and set the resistance on the shoulder pull at a weight greater than their own weight. They hunker down then and grimace and try to pull the bar down, but lo, the overweighted shoulder pull becomes a chin-up. Up they go, their own bodies, toward the bar they're trying to pull down. Everyone should get at least one good look at the eyes of a man who finds himself rising toward what he wants to pull down to himself.
That's David Foster Wallace here at WNYC on the Leonard Lopate Show in 1996. He was 34, and at that moment, he became a literary superstar. In addition to everything else that Infinite Jest is about, it deals with drugs and mental illness, which Wallace himself struggled with. He'd been on antidepressant drugs since he was 23. And then in 2008, Wallace hanged himself in his garage in Southern California. D.T. Max is a writer for The New Yorker and has written the so far definitive biography of David Foster Wallace. It's called Every Love Story is a Ghost Story. I asked him how he approached writing a straightforward book about a writer with such a brilliantly flamboyant voice.
Well, one of the lessons that Wallace's life teaches you is that you really can't change your prose style. I mean, you can try. He tried.
Right.
My God, he tried. He tried as hard as any person ever could to sort of change that complicated connection between the nature of your mind and the nature of your writing. This is how I write.
Right.
I'm very,
right.
very interested in fact and in letting fact speak and getting out of the way of fact. I'll also say for what it's worth that I felt that, you know, David's great cause in Infinite Jest, but also afterward, was to write a kind of realistic novel for a world that was no longer real. And I felt like biography should return the favor, and that in some small way I should be trying to write a biography that looked and felt like a biography of a figure who did not, you know, who believed that, who lived his life in a world that was no longer real. So, you know, this is new ground, and I'm not really arguing for any sort of radical innovations in my book. It was more a kind of decision not to do certain things, not to be comprehensive. Like, for instance, in biography, historically, you get a great emphasis on where someone came from. But I don't really feel in the America of 2010 that where you come from, although it matters to David, might, you know, arguably not be as important as what you've watched on TV or what music you listen to. You know, I was very interested, among other things, in just how do you write the story of a modern middle-class American?
It seems as though the way he never grew up, and of course there are millions and millions of Americans who in the last 50 years who never quite grow up in various ways that are often benign. People can be forever young in mostly benign ways. He, instead of just being the guy who keeps partying and never dresses like a grown-up and all the rest, he had this existential angst of an adolescent that he never got rid of. Does that seem true?
No, absolutely. No, I think you're absolutely right that what's Infinite Jest but a novel about young men? It's got other things in it, but it's a novel about a bunch of kids in a tennis academy. And in that sense, it really is a kind of descendant of Catcher in the Rye. It's another prep school novel. David never did grow up in the ways that you've kind of indicated. He never had children. So, but yes, there's a perpetual adolescence. And I think in that way, you know, John Updike, I think, once said that in America, a man is just a failed boy. And in that sense, David was a complete success. The other thing that I really, really grew to understand in writing the book is that David sunk an enormous amount of his life and his maturity into his 12-step program life. And that the David that people saw at the university he teaches at Illinois State University and then at Pomona, you know, was in some ways not – certainly it wasn't the whole David. There was a whole nother David living an almost entirely separate life in these 12-step meetings. He was, you know, he was sponsoring people. He was being sponsored. He was helping people. He was writing stuff for people. He was looking out for people. You know, he had entered a parallel community.
Do you have a sense of what the regard for David Foster Wallace will be 25 years hence?
Boy, 25 years is a long time. Well, I believe he will grow for this generation and the next generations as a figure to whom they can refer when we all want to say, well, we matter. You know, Infinite Jest really sits alone, I think, as a novel from that moment. You know, it wasn't the way people thought the millennial novel would look. And in some ways, it's dated in a kind of appealingly strange way. But especially in the way that David broke open language, the way that he changed, I think, the rules about what literary language ought to sound like, that weird combination, which now sounds, of course, you know, somewhat webby, that weird combination of high and low diction, of sentences that twist around. You know, it's pompous to invoke someone like, you know, Samuel Johnson, but I mean, it's prose that's different enough from the prose other people were writing that I really think that book is going to, in fact, become more interesting to readers and even more, I think, to scholars and a certain kind of close reader. You know, maybe more the way Dickens relates to Victorian England, you know, an artifact that also inhabits that time and infuses that time with its energy. To me, when you remember where we all were in 1996, I mean, that's an extraordinary – it's an extraordinary guess that he made with his talent.
Absolutely true. Dan Max, it's been a pleasure having you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
D.T. Max is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. His biography of David Foster Wallace is called Every Love Story is a Ghost Story. And I'd love to hear what kind of an impact Infinite Jest may have had on you. Tell us your story at studio360.org. Still ahead, the rock musician Shilpa Ray's strict Indian parents have never heard her music, and she intends to keep it that way.
I think it's a little too intense for them. All that cursing, my God.
Shilpa Ray plays live right here. That is next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. The singer-songwriter Shilpa Ray grew up with these strict Indian immigrant parents, traditionalists who forbade Western music in their home. So Ray did what any rebellious teenager would do. She secretly binged on punk rock records that she'd borrowed from the library, which is how she found and fell in love with bands way before her time, like the Velvet Underground, the Stooges, and the New York Dolls. For the last decade or so, Ray has been making her own punky rock infused with traditional Indian music. On her latest record, last year's Savage, Ray still screams with the best of them, but with something like the intimacy of a cabaret singer. She recently came into WNYC's own cabaret, The Green Space, where we had the place to ourselves, and I asked her to play some songs.
Scraping my eyes, the banners on my bar, you're begging me to tag.
Beautiful. That was Shilpa Ray performing Pop Song for Euthanasia off her new record, last year's Savage. Now, on the record, that song and other songs you're going to play today, you're accompanied by a regular band, guitars, drums.
Yeah.
You're playing the harmonium, which you also play on the record and have always played. Why the harmonium?
Well, I took classical vocal training when I was really young. My parents made me do that, and this was the instrument you used to accompany your voice.
And this was Indian classical because they were Indian immigrants.
Yes. And I hated it. I couldn't stand playing. Who wants to play harmonium? But
So even as a little kid, you had to play that?
Yeah. Yeah. Huh.
So you started playing as a little kid. You know it's a thing you know how to play. But then so you get to be 20, whatever you are, and you're a rock and roll person. Were you just saying, I'm going to do this because no one else is, and it's
no,
weird?
No, absolutely. It totally wasn't like that. I wanted to play guitar. I wasn't allowed to play guitar for a long time as a kid. Yeah. And then I finally bought an acoustic guitar when I was 16, and I didn't understand, because I played piano as a kid too, so I didn't know where the notes were on a string instrument, so I never stuck with guitar, and I ended up, this was lying around my parents' place, and I just took it, and it was just sort of by default.
It was the instrument that was around that you knew how to play.
Yeah, that I was most comfortable, and it was portable because I wasn't going to drag a piano around.
Right. But it must affect the songs you write and how you write. No?
It does. It has its own breath. So how I would compose a song on piano versus playing on harmonium is completely different.
Right.
How I would sing over it, it's so different.
Because it's kind of like a duet.
Yeah,
because
this is playing exactly, it's almost controlling how I'm singing in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't feel like doing something, then I can't. It's kind of the Meg White of my band.
There you go.
Meg White was always
and
dictating where the white stripes are going to go.
White. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's still like it's the strong leader
yeah.
The silent strong leader you wouldn't guess, but that's the case.
And your parents, they were teaching you to play this and sing classical Indian music because they were trying to keep their little American daughter traditional?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it was also a way of keeping us disciplined so we wouldn't get into trouble. I guess all immigrants have this fear of, or they don't. They either embrace American culture or they're so fearful that everything will become destroyed.
Yes.
Massive fears when we were growing up.
So it's ironic that this instrument, this vehicle of let's keep Shilpa traditional is now this demonic rock and roll.
I know. It's what prevented me from going to med school and stuff, right?
Yeah. So I read somewhere that like your mother has never listened to you.
No, she hasn't. And neither of my folks have listened to me. I think it's a little too intense for them. You know,
really?
I think it would be intense for them to listen to me.
But I find that strange.
You do?
Yes.
All that cursing? My God.
Whatever. They've lived in this country for 30-odd years.
My cousins and my aunts and uncles have heard me.
Yeah. At what moment did you decide, like, I really want to make music. This is what I want to do. And music like this.
I think it was always in the back of my head, and I was always trying to do it, but never was full force, like I'm going to be a rock star until my early 20s, and I took my first hit of ecstasy, whatever, and me and my friend were rolling in the park, and I just started singing on the street, and she looked at me, and she was like, I would pay to see you do that, and I was like, wow, I just never thought about it. And she's like, she knew I wrote poetry and stuff. And she's like, you can really put two and two together, you know, and
this
try
is like
this.
College time?
Mm-hmm.
And so the drug wears off. Do you think like, whoa, that was a crazy thing? Or you think like, no,
it stuck.
This was an epiphany.
It totally stuck with me. It felt like something I was actually going to be able to do.
And you
versus
did.
Like what I was studying, which I was like, I'm never going to be able to do this.
What
you
were
know?
You studying?
I was in business school. I was originally going to be an engineer like my dad, and I knew I was going to fail out. I knew I was going to fail out the first week when the lecturer said, look to your left, look to your right, and, you know, not everyone's going to make it.
Person.
I was going to be the person that's not going to make it.
Listening to this new album and previous music of yours, there's this kind of noir thing. This album, a lot of it sounds sort of like Bertolt Brecht and like Your Lotte Lenya or something. Do you have that sense, or is that something that you connect with?
It's very Bengali. I mean, it's strange. I guess a lot of people don't know what the regional breakdown is in India.
Not I.
But I know, it's hard because it's like a whole other world of music. But the province that my parents are from, like, all the regional music is pretty dense and dark.
Huh.
And it's called having a throaty or lead-like voice because we're from a delta, which is very similar to
over
how
in
they
the
describe
west toward
blues.
Bangladesh?
Yeah, it's like the Ganges Delta.
Yeah.
So everyone sings like they're moaning about something that's really tragic. I found it very interesting being introduced to the blues that the Mississippi Delta was where the blues originated from, and it sounds very similar to the blues.
It has been a pleasure, Shuppel. Thank you. And
will you
play another song before?
Yes.
What will this be?
This one's called Burning Bride.
I know it well already. That's Shilpa Ray playing Burning Bride off of last year's Savage. This month, you can go see her. She's touring the country. And at studio360.org, you can hear all three songs she played for us here. Plus, you can hear my full conversation with her, including this great story she told about how a camp counselor at Hindu Heritage Camp set her on the path to becoming a punk rocker. That's it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. And remember, check out the details of our Defile Your Taxes challenge at studio360.org/defile. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our team here includes
Jenny Lawton,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Louis Mitchell,
Matt Frassica,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Karen Chikurji,
Danielle Fox,
Afi Yelidu,
Kate Essig.
And before I leave you, last weekend, the team here and I watched the Oscars, and we invited you to all join us online during the broadcast to play our awards night bingo. We want to thank everybody who played along, especially the people who tweeted their winning bingo cards. They are Sue, Lucinda, Joel, Robin, Aaron, Anne, Amira, Jim, Craig, Donna, Linda, Thomas, Kevin, Jason, Timothea, and Jake. Thank you, everyone, so much.
Sk-
Studio 360 is supported by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, putting on concerts for wolves.
Until we teach the animals capitalism, I don't expect to be collecting any money at the door. So I can't pay anyone. I haven't been paid. And everyone who's helped me with these has donated their time.
Do animals have culture? We'll find out next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.